Stephanie, would you call us to order, please?
Joyce Dill.
Here.
David Happ. Cheryl Hanley Maxwell.
Here.
Mike Smith.
Here.
Deb Roush.
Here.
Item agenda 3, do we have any additions to the agenda today? Citizen input or public participation.
Good morning. I know you have a full agenda, but I just two or three items I wanted to run by you real quick. About a week and a half ago, Senate Bill 955, which is the DSP wage bill, did get through the Senate. So it's like deja vu all over again, I guess, because a year ago we got it through the Senate, we got it through the House, and as you know, the governor waited till the last day to veto it. And so we're trying to up it up again to try to get it going. And so now the efforts are all in the House. Lynn communicated with me earlier in the week, and I guess your association is also now supporting the bill, and that's great. So as we go into the House, we'll be sending in and doing some more information, but of course the main pressure also, we have to get through that, but then also to get some bipartisan support, because the belief is that we can possibly get it through the House again, but you got to get at least 4 Republicans to come over, because in case there's an override, that you can do that. And so that's part of the strategy. So, you know, we all know that it's going to be challenging. We've been fighting this fight for 2 years, even if we get it, because then everybody's going to expect $15 an hour, and that's not going to happen. And then, of course, like local funders, it pressures you because, because it's going to come up for everybody, not just the state-funded people. So those are the challenges we need to fight. You know, those are the ones we need to look forward to get that done. So we're cautiously optimistic about that. And in a few days, maybe about as soon as Friday, but by next week, we'll be doing more of a postcard campaign. So hopefully we'll get some postcards, and you'll be willing to write your story and send that in too. And that target is to the governor's office, and it's happening around the state. We're going to start with at least 500 locally and generate that and see how we can do that. So we'll get more information on that. Second thing I think is to negotiate the budget, which impacts you, which impacts all of us here, is, you know, a lot of the negotiations is about a freeze on property tax. And so I don't know politically what you can really do as a board of that, but I think you need to be very aware, because if there's property tax freezes, that means your ability to get more funding to services to people with disabilities gets limited really quickly. So I just that's as close as I'll get to a political statement, I guess, today, but I think it does really impact us. And the final thing is a couple years ago, we went forth with a local person here because of people in group homes couldn't get insulin injections, and there was a major rule change that was proposed with our association, IARP, and it got through, and I was told this week it finally got through the Rules Committee, JCAR, which that means many people. Now, DSPs will be able to give some insulin. There's some restrictions to that, so it doesn't open the door for everybody, and we still have a challenge with one individual we're trying to serve, but that piece of change of rule is going to allow hundreds and hundreds of people around the state that have diabetes to be served more in a less restrictive setting, where before they'd have to go into an ICFDD or more restrictive setting. So we're excited about that. It's happening statewide, too. So thank you.
Thank you, Dale. Mark, do you have any MHB input for us today?
The Mental Health Board will be meeting this evening. They're not ready to vote on a set of recommendations from the staff. They are still discussing the applications. They had 41 applications to consider. They also took a deep dive into the applications and posed questions to agencies, got lots of information back from the agencies. So they have a 114-page board packet for a study session tonight. So hopefully after that, they'll be ready to vote. And we're going to try to turn around a very quick recommendations memo for them so that they can meet next Wednesday, May 24th, and hopefully vote. From the set of DD applications, we will be recommending 4, and those are in this decision memo. When you get to those, if you agree with our recommendation to ask the Mental Health Board to fund them, or if you modify in any way those 4, they are ready to receive that recommendation from you. So hopefully, if anything goes wrong on May 24th with those 4 votes, we would return to those later. We might have another meeting. Anyway, so that's where they're at.
Okay, the board minutes from the April 19th meeting are on page 3. I'd like to ask for a motion to approve them as presented.
I move that we accept those as presented.
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Okay, we're approved. Okay, my turn. I just really will keep this very brief. I just wanted to make note that in this allocation cycle, 12 agencies submitted a total of 23 requests for funding through either the DDB or the MHB. And this time around, we don't have enough money to fully fund all those requests. I know that a great deal of consideration was given to each application. We used our priorities as a guide in coming to the recommendations. And I want everybody to know that the decisions the board will make today are not going to be taken lightly. And I want to just, again, thank all the applicants for your work to date, all of your efforts in the process. And I also want to thank our administrative staff and the fellow board members for all of your time and efforts. This has been crunch time. It's the busiest time of the year for us. And I just want to thank everybody for all your hard work.
I had to get up at about 1:30 and write it down because it was just keeping me awake. But I first want to respond to Dale's note about the possible unintended consequences of a DSP wage increase, which we do support. And when I talk with our state association and even National Association committee calls, this is an issue across the country. It is causing harm to providers, so that there's really no other way to do this than to raise the frontline wages. Then we may need to make some other changes. But I would anticipate that a broke state will just owe you more money, right, for longer periods of time. I would also anticipate that the eligibility requirements will be adjusted in order to make up for what they, what the obligation takes out of wages. So this legislation pushes the rates to be adjusted, which is long overdue, but I do think we could expect a surprise like that. And on that note, I would hope that everybody who's got people who have not been deemed eligible by Mary Rasher at the ISC and put on PUNS would hurry up and get there while we can, because making somebody locally eligible in that way can really help later when we need to make a case with the state. And if the state changes their criteria, we will also have a wonderful justification for continuing local funding for those people. So I would say hurry, and let's keep Mary up all night. So then here comes what I wrote at 1:30 in the morning. This was some of these applications were very well written. They all reflect, I think, a deep commitment from all of you, and you also show that commitment by coming here every month and talking with us and listening to our deliberations. So I feel very grateful to live in a community that has people working with people with DD and caring about them so much that they do this work and they write these wonderful applications and have great ideas. So it was a challenge, and on that I want to welcome our new Associate Director for DD, Kim Bowdry, who came to the office just in time to see what I was thinking about the recommendations for funding. And so there are 2 things to know before we start going through those recommendations. One is that our last year at this time, we made allocations decisions based on a levy that did not come true. There was an error in the calculation of that levy, and so when it came down to it, the year we're in right now, we're living on far less revenue than we expected. But it hasn't affected the agency contracts because we're also living in a very unusual year with our administrative budget. So we won't have to, we won't be spreading any pain. I think we're going to be fine. But that's why when you look at the difference between what's available in 17 and 2018, it's not a huge increase. And the increase that does exist is because we are able to bring down our administrative costs permanently too, but we can't do that every year. We can't cut as much as we did this year in the coming years. So we'll just try to do the best we can to control those costs, and we have good advice from board members on how to do that. But it was a good year to remember that this is soft money, that it's an annual collection of property taxes, and that property taxes are subject to things like property tax freezes and shifts in the economy and hospital tax settlements that never get settled. So we either have extra money someday or a really big liability sitting on our budget. So depending on how that goes. So I've learned a lot about how this is not necessarily money we can always count on. So I think that when the board members are asking questions like what other resources are available to support this program, I don't think that means they don't love the suggestions or the ideas. I think that means they're realistic about where the money comes from too, and the fact that it's finite. And when we ask about duplication of effort, I think that's, from my perspective, I don't see very much duplication of effort, but that is our responsibility to make sure that we're using the money as efficiently as possible. So again, that type of talk is not meant to disrespect your programs or your work. The other thing is we will be working on new reporting requirements in order to get a better idea of potential duplication of effort and also of how the programs work together. We would like to work with some of you to work the programs more closely together. There were lots of applications to support linkage and referral activities, and those are only meaningful if there are things to refer people to. So we need to make sure we're striking the right balance. And we also have an obligation from above to report on outcomes, and we recognize how difficult it is to identify actual outcomes, but we're in that with you, and we're going to have to work on that together too. Transition supports were also a major theme in this set of applications, and we are trying to design a way to work pieces of those applications together so that, once again, we don't end up duplicating effort or taking the responsibility away from the schools. And also, there is a designated independent service coordinator. We'd like to support that role as much as possible while also keeping the programs vibrant. So I don't know if we got there with these recommendations, and you all will have a chance to ask questions about them. So anyway, that's all. It's 1:30 in the morning.
Agenda item 9 are our staff reports, our consultant report, and we are going to defer. Is that correct? Okay. Moving on to item 10, agency information.
Vicki Nicewander from the Illinois Association of Microboards and Cooperatives. I was reading all of your staff recommendations for the proposals the last couple of days, and noted that the there was a concern about attendance at IEPs and so forth, specifically indicated in others, but also in our proposal. Just to clarify, we have never attended an IEP meeting, nor have we supported as an advocate families in the school district. We are working with some families who have kids in school, but our entire project is something that does not duplicate what anybody else in the county does, and that is creating teams that mobilize around individuals. And whether those folks have funding or not, we still are able to make changes for them based upon the connections that they have within those teams. So I would ask you to reconsider the cut, which amounts to about 20% of our funding, far more than any other agency is having to take. We are just getting started with this project. We have had great results, exceeded what we had committed to over the past year, and hope to do even more in the coming year. But taking a hit like that would really make it difficult to achieve that. And that's all I have.
Hi, I'm Becca Obachowski with Community Choices. I also wanted to just speak for a moment about the provision of not attending IEP meetings in the contracts and in the recommendations. In one of our proposals for our customized employment department, we had proposed a transition specific halftime position to support families in a longer period as they're getting ready for their young adult to transition out of school, In reference to the IEP meetings, it would not be that we would attend all IEP meetings for any student, but rather the families that chose to work with us over that longer period of time, we would hope that participating in those IEP meetings would be something that would be possible, since at that point, you know, we would be sort of trying to incentivize the schools by agreeing to provide services once the student had actually aged out, and then also just trying to create sort of that seamless blend of services from the school to the sort of adult world, and not just to come to IEP meetings and describe what we do, but really more as a partnership and as an agreement that we would be continuing services with that person. So I just thought I'd clarify that.
I don't know. Is it okay to ask a question during agency? If there were an exception in that each time you attended an IEP, you would create a summary report of the activities and the purpose and for whom it was. I mean, is that possible? Is it asking a lot? Because I think written reports are a lot of extra work sometimes, but that might be a way that we could understand what the attendance at IEP was for.
No, and I think that would be perfectly reasonable, especially in the context of what we were trying to do, if that portion of the program was funded, because it would be part of a longer process with that student, that young adult, that family, where we were working with them over, you know, we would be continuing working. It wouldn't just be a report saying, like, well, we told them about what we did. It would be, you know, we helped plan how this was going to work and what sort of supports would need to be in place and how the, you know, the transition from one set of services and service providers, i.e. the school, would then sort of blend with what we were going to be doing after that and where, you know, where families' roles would fit in. So I imagine that there would probably, just within the documentation that we normally keep, there would be something to that effect already, but we would certainly be able to sort of notate it as the specific IEP, and that also wouldn't be the only involvement that we would hope the family would have with us, because I think what we've found and what some of the other people here in the audience have found as they've talked to schools and different stakeholders in the transition period of life is that just attending the IEP meeting isn't effective. But if there's longer term sort of collaboration between the schools and between service providers and between the family, that there can be really good outcomes, because there's not a firewall and there's also not a cliff to fall off of the day that you end school. And what we really hope is that there would be sort of that bridge, and that one of the steps along that bridge would be attending IEP meetings, but not the only one.
Good morning. Patty Walters from DSC. I also just want to kind of echo that same concern. If I know that the funding is being recommended, I think, for a position through RPC to support those activities, and they have good working relationships with all the providers. But when a family requests your presence at one of those meetings, I don't know how we not support that.
I think the concern is twofold. We are spending a lot of money on people just going to IEP meetings.
I understand that.
And that's a lot of local dollars.
And I understand that. So I don't know that we will discontinue going if a family requests that we go. And if we can't report that, then that's unfortunate. But when you're looking to meet the need of a family that's requesting a service, I think one of the hardships that could come from this is that the families have an opportunity to invite who they want to the IEP, and potentially several providers are represented, and they have an opportunity to collectively gather some information in one sitting versus going kind of on tour, and that hardship may be passed on to the families a little bit. There's ways around it. I mean, if it isn't going to be something that's allowable, we'll work around that. But I think there's a difference between a school inviting people in and a family inviting. They are feeling like they're asking for some advocacy at the table during that transition time. So regardless of what provider that is, there's benefit to that. So I think we'd have to get creative, and we would certainly draw on the working relationship that RPC has with all of the providers. But I don't really see that component as a duplication just because there are multiple people represented if the families request the presence. So I think it's tough. I understand the resources that are going into it, that's a concern.
It seems like a really expensive way to tell families what the agencies have when the TPC could be the center for that information and make sure the schools understand what the agencies offer. And that expense is borne by this board.
I guess one of the things I would suggest after you make all the funding decisions is kind of a meeting with provider representation, RPC, and maybe some families to really talk about what we want to bridge the gap with the schools through that transition, because the last year is typically too late to start that relationship anyway. There are some that we are involved with for years, and there are some that you hear, or you're invited at the very last meeting, and there's some you find out 2 weeks before graduation that they're kind of counting on you. So even with that in place to where you can be invited, there's still families that aren't getting that information. So it really is about the school relationship and then the provider access to families. That I know you're working on that, but if there can be something more collaborative after funding decisions are made, that might be a really good resource for us to pull together. So, thank you.
Good morning. I'm Lisa Benson from Regional Planning Commission. Hearing what the ladies have just talked about and thinking about coordination, to me it makes a lot of sense. If someone has been an established provider, my anticipation would be that a planning consultant would actually bring them in. They'd be a part of that plan. So if families would have a established provider, I would envision that they would be a part of that and being invited, because they're an established provider and should be a part of the transition planning. So just wanted to share that. So I completely understand what the ladies are saying.
Well, I appreciate the comments and the concerns, and I think Kim knows this too. It's just, I think part of what happens is that it's the school's responsibility to plan transition, and I think that there has become a habit of simply inviting as many providers as possible to the IEPs because that looks good. I've heard that that's why it happens. And so if the DD board chooses to bear the expense of all of that, I have, this is the DD board's money to decide about, not mine. But I do think that for all of the positive that can come out of being at IEPs for a child's last few years of school, there are some negatives that we've heard about this year. We did ask through the contracts that there be some collaboration around these issues all during this current year. And what we've learned is that some families don't want all these people sitting in their meetings. For even if they are open with the agencies, that's not always what they want. So I think we need to be responsible for a plan that supports what is best for the individuals and the families, however we get there. So thank you for the input.
Okay, moving on to our financial report, our very short financial report on page 6. I'd like to make a motion that we approve the financial report as presented.
A second.
Discussion? All in favor?
Aye.
Yes. Opposed? It is approved. Okay, new business. The staff recommendations for FY 2018 program funding begin on page 7 with the spreadsheet and proceed from there. So we can begin
Before we get started on that, could we review what we did last year, which was I think we funded two pilot programs, and I'd like to know how those two programs, if they worked, are we looking at the continuation of those programs, or are we not?
They're so, both included. You're right.
We had a mid-year report in the last. I can go get it too if you want. You're okay with that? Okay. So we did look at the mid-year results for each of those programs. I looked at the financials too, and compared where they were at related to the utilization. And each of them has applied for another year of funding, and we've made a recommendation for partial funding of each of those contracts. And I, unfortunately, as Vicki Nyswander pointed out, the recommendation may not be affordable. This is something we usually leave to contract negotiations, but it may be a question that you have for them. Are they affordable at these reduced amounts?
Okay, I just wanted to make sure that we had evaluated them for their continuance as well as the contract, because that's the reason we called them pilot programs, was to find out should these be continued on an annual basis. And so I guess you're having them in, but at less than we gave them last year. Is that correct?
Some of what we've presented is based on affordability, just that there's less money than we would need to fund everything. There is some additional information from one of those agencies. Vicki, did you submit additional info also? So both of them have provided additional information, which is on the next few pages, that may help because the activities of one of them will be very different in the second year.
So, thank you.
Happy to answer any questions that you have, or I can wait until you come to our proposal for consideration.
Mike, did you want to talk about each of these programs now, or do you want to
I had read everything in here. My concern was we identified them specifically as pilot programs a year ago, and mm-hmm. I think we needed to address the fact that we had called them pilot programs, and are we now moving them from that stage of will they or will they not continue to the stage of where we're going to be funding them? So I just thought we should address those two as pilots before we addressed everything. So I'm satisfied with what we've done.
Lynn, did you have comments about the decision memorandum specifically before we begin discussing each? No.
I already did it.
Right. Right.
So we're on the staff recommendations decision memo, and there, a whole bunch of the pages are refresher on the priorities and how we got there and the statute. And so I think, what page did you end up at? 25?
Yes, at the bottom of page 25 is our first staff recommendation for United Cerebral Palsy. Are you going to read? Do you want me to read them?
Do you want to have discussion first?
After the motion. We have a motion to discuss, right?
We need to have
right, so we need to read it.
Then discuss, okay. Then vote. Motion second.
All right, I will just go ahead and read this staff recommendation. United Cerebral Palsy, Land of Lincoln Vocational Services, their request is for $34,590. This application aligns with the priority for employment services and supports. A special provision will be added to the contract to ensure collaboration with providers of similar services. The program reports on hours worked by participants, a measure of value, and the motion to approve funding of $34,590 for United Cerebral Palsy Land of Lincoln Vocational Services as presented in this memorandum. Is there a second?
I'll second.
Okay. Discussion. Okay, so no discussion. So I don't have to do the
roll call.
Okay. Stephanie, please call roll.
Cheryl Hanley Maxwell. Mike Smith.
Approve.
Deb Roush.
Approve.
Joyce Still.
Approve.
Okay, great. Rural Champaign County Special Education Cooperative Disability Resource Expo. This is a new funding request in the amount of $66,781. It aligns with the priority for linkage and advocacy for people with IDDD. It features a large-scale annual anti-stigma and networking event with online and printed resource guide available year-round and several stakeholder meetings for coordination and community awareness. For 10 years, this event has been funded through the CCMHB and CCDDB administrative budget, and it may continue there as we resolve the challenges related to transitioning to an agency contract. The motion is to deny funding of $66,781 for Rural Champaign County Special Education Cooperative Disability Resource Expo as presented in this memorandum. Second? Chandra, roll call. Oh, discussion, pardon me.
I just have a question. I have a question about the wording. And it says for 10 years this event has been funded through the administrative budget and may continue. Should we change may to shall continue?
Yes.
Okay. Sounds good to me.
Can I speak?
I just wanted to make the point that we were not denying that the expo was going to continue. We were just leaving it in the administrative budget area instead of bringing it out into an agency.
Right.
Correct.
May I speak?
Sure.
That's okay. So I was very excited about this particular organization taking it over. There's all kinds of great potential there, but we're about to be fully staffed again, and I think we can keep this for another year, and I think that we can get a really good idea about what it takes while we work out the kinks of moving it to an agency if we do decide to do that. This agency is still involved with the expo anyway, so.
So in the long run, I'd like to see that we get a financial accounting of the entire activity and see what the school districts are putting into this, because this is part of their responsibility as well.
Okay. Okay, thank you. That's a good point, Cheryl. Is there any other discussion? So just to reiterate, I'm going to read that sentence again, that for 10 years this event has been funded through the CCMHB, CCDDB administrative budget and will continue there as we resolve the challenges related to transitioning to an agency contract. Motion is to deny funding of $66,781 for Rural Champaign County Special Education Cooperative Disability Resource Expo as presented in this memorandum. Okay. Do we need to do a motion and a second again since there's a change? Okay, Chandra, would you call roll, please?
Mike Smith?
Here.
Deb Roush?
Here.
Joe Still?
Yes.
Cheryl Hanley Maxwell?
Really here?
Yes, pardon me.
Don't we have to say approve, deny, modify?
Approved.
Then I'll change mine to approve.
Yeah.
You're approving the denial.
We're approving the denial. That's correct.
I approve the denial as well.
Okay, I'm going to read all of these, right?
Are you okay with that?
That's okay. The next one is for Rosecrans, Champaign-Urbana Coordination of Services, DDMI. The request is for $34,126. It aligns with the priority for linkage and advocacy for people with IDDD, improve access to behavioral health services and benefits, and collaborates with other providers toward a system of care. A special provision will be included to ensure collaboration with CCRPC and with other CCDDB, CCMHB-funded programs to improve coordination and minimize duplication of effort. CCDDB and CCMHB funds should not be used to pay for staff time at IEP and MDC meetings. There's a motion to approve the funding of $34,126 for Rosecrans Champaign-Urbana Coordination of Services, DDMI, as presented in this memorandum. Is there a second? Discussion? Just to reiterate, the italicized part is not part of the motion, so I probably should not read anything in italics.
Oh, no, when you get to motion, it's clear.
Stephanie, roll call.
Joy Still.
Approved.
Cheryl Hanley Maxwell.
Approved.
Mike Smith.
Approved.
Deb Roush.
Approved.
All right, we're taking turns now. persons assuming control of their environment, PACE, request is for $40,546, aligns with priority for linkage and advocacy for people with IDDD, and proposes an innovation to support individuals transitioning from school. A special provision will be included to ensure collaboration with CCRPC and other CCDDB, CCMHB-funded programs to improve coordination and minimize duplication of effort, including for transition. The motion is to approve funding of $40,546 for persons assuming control of their environment, opportunities for independence as presented in this memorandum.
Roll call. Discussion. A roll call.
Cheryl Hanley Maxwell.
Not Joyce. Did you already vote?
No. They switched it.
Oh, we're going in a different order. Okay. Approve.
Mike Smith.
Approve.
Deb Roush.
Approve.
Joyce Still.
Approve.
My turn?
It's your turn.
The next one is the Association for Micro Boards and Cooperatives. AMAC Building Inclusive Communities requested $65,700. The motion is to approve partial funding of $52,750. I'll make the motion.
Second. Is there a discussion?
I have a question. Because I wasn't here last year, I don't know if this is one of the pilots.
It is one of the pilots.
Okay. The other question I have is, what other sources of funding might they have to help support some of this work?
Should we ask the representative from the agency?
That's a good idea.
My thought was, potentially there's a way to use some of the Medicaid waiver funding that some of the people have, but we haven't had an opportunity to talk about that at all. So,
sorry. We spoke briefly before the meeting, and of the 12 families that we are currently supporting with our funds through the CCDDB, there are 5 or 6 of those individuals that do have home-based funding. The rest do not. So the suggestion was made that we could potentially be a service facilitator for that group. With reduced funding, that would make it even more difficult to achieve our goals, because a lot of paperwork is entailed with service facilitation. I just don't know that that would be enough to balance out the funding, and we are currently, by the end of this year, we will having committed to supporting 10 teams in development. We have, by the end of this fiscal year, we will have 14 teams in process, and we have committed to adding an additional 10 for next year, doing person-centered planning facilitation training, and then also adding quarterly meetings for the teams, which we had one of those this past week and a half when David Wetherill was here. We're going to continue that in the plan if we have the support to do that, and then also developing a leadership team in the community, starting with the people who are members of those individual teams who are community members, and getting some input from the community on how we can further the goals of teams. So a cut of 20% means a cut in staff time ultimately, and that will make it extremely difficult to do. If we did service facilitation, that might make up for about, what is the rate, $40 an hour for service facilitation times 12. You do the math. That's not a lot of money.
Right. How much of your budget did you plan for the actual training itself?
The actual training itself?
Training around the person-centered planning.
The person-centered planning.
Yeah.
We had planned, and I don't have those numbers in front of me, we have to hire a co-trainer, which is a cost of $1,500, and then we were, with grant money, going to provide supplies and food and so forth for that group of probably 15 people for a 3-day period. So I would say that amount would come to roughly $2,500. Space is being donated.
Are you the only organization that does person-centered planning in the area?
We are the only person that trains person-centered planning facilitators.
So could you charge a small amount for the person-centered planning training?
We would have to.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
I'm feeling rather uncomfortable with this cut. I would like to find a way to, I'm not feeling uncomfortable with the cut totally, but I'm feeling uncomfortable with the magnitude of the cut, given the effectiveness of person-centered planning.
Well, this is not the only person-centered planning. This is
This is the only training on PATH, right?
Oh.
Is that right? Can you explain what's going on with person-centered planning?
All of the ISCs are now beginning the process of person-centered planning for all individuals with waiver-funded services.
Gotcha. Okay.
So every individual beginning July 1st and going on throughout the current year will have a new person-centered plan completed by the independent service coordinator.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
That's for people who have state funding. For the locally funded programs, all of the agencies are required to do some kind of person-centered planning process, and they submit the materials to us. There are as many different person-centered processes as there are agencies because they've developed them themselves. But none of them are PATH is unique to this organization.
Yeah, so if I could just add, what we do is train facilitators of person-centered planning, so it's a much deeper dive into what person-centered planning means. And rather than filling out a form, it's about really listening to the individual and making sure that we are focused on their hopes and dreams rather than what is convenient for the agencies.
And I think that was the state's goal in having the ISCs complete the person-centered plan so that it was an independent entity completing those plans.
Okay.
Any further discussion? Stephanie, roll call.
Joyce Still.
Approved.
Cheryl Hanley-Maxwell.
Can I approve with reservations? Okay, so I'm going to approve with reservations.
Mike Smith?
Approve.
Deb Roush?
Approve.
I think we can. It's approval, but on a record, you're not happy about it.
Yeah, okay. This is for Developmental Services Center Service Coordination. The request is for $423,165. It aligns with the priority for linkage and advocacy for people with IDDD. To reduce risks of Medicaid supplementation and conflict of interest, reporting requirements may be revised. A special provision will be included to ensure collaboration with CCRPC and other CCDDB and CCMHB funded programs to improve coordination and minimize duplication of effort, including for transition. Motion to approve partial funding of $410,838 for the Developmental Services Center Service Coordination as presented in this memorandum.
Is there a second?
Second.
Discussion. Roll call.
Mike Smith.
Approved.
Joyce Still?
Approve.
Cheryl Hanley-Maxwell?
Approve.
Deb Roush?
Approve.
The next one is for Developmental Services Center, Integrated Site-Based Services, Community First. And there's a little typo in the written version, so I'm going to correct that. The request is for $807,605 for a two-year term. This is to support the transformation from sheltered-based services to meaningful community life for those served. Individual needs and preference assessments are central. Motion to approve partial funding of $799,090 for a one-year term for Developmental Services Center, Integrated Site-Based Services, Community First. Second?
Second.
Discussion? Roll call.
Joyce Still.
Approved.
Cheryl Hanley-Maxwell.
Approved.
Mike Smith.
Approved.
Deb Roush.
Approved.
Developmental Services Center, Individual and Family Support. The request is for $399,055, aligns with priority for non-work community life and flexible support. Motion to deny funding for Developmental Services Center Individual and Family Support as presented in this memorandum. By agreement, the Champaign County Mental Health Board will provide partial funding of $392,649 for this program.
Second. Discussion? Roll call.
Joy Still.
Approve.
Cheryl Hanley Maxwell.
Approve.
Mike Smith.
Approve.
Deb Roush.
My turn. Developmental Services Center Family Development Center request for $579,150. Approve 562-280.
Second.
Second.
If you've got a second, we'll discuss.
Oh. Discussion?
Yeah.
Roll call.
Cheryl Hanley Maxwell.
Approved.
Mike Smith.
Approved.
Joy Still.
Approved.
Deb Roush.
Approved. My turn. Developmental Services Center Community Choices Employment First Program. This request is for $82,400 for a two-year program. It aligns with the priority for employment services and supports. Recommend that the program collect some demographic and residency data on the businesses and families engaged. The motion is to approve partial funding of $80,000 for a one-year contract for the Developmental Services Center Employment First, as presented in this memorandum.
Second.
Discussion. Roll call.
Joy Still.
Approve.
Cheryl Hanley Maxwell.
Approved.
Mike Smith.
Approved.
Deb Roush.
Approved. Developmental Services Center Connections. The request is for $90,000. It aligns with the priority for employment services and supports to support the transformation from shelter-based services to meaningful community life for those served. Individual needs and preference assessments are central. Motion to approve partial funding of $85,000 for the Developmental Services Center Connections, as presented in this memorandum.
Second.
Discussion. Roll call.
Mike Smith.
Approved.
Joy Still.
Approved.
Cheryl Hanley Maxwell.
Approved.
Deb Roush.
Approved.
Sorry. Developmental Services Center Community Employment. Request is for $361,370 with a two-year term. Aligns with priority for employment supports and services. A special provision will be included to ensure collaboration with CCRPC and other CCDDB, CCMHB funded programs to improve coordination and minimize duplication of effort. Motion to approve funding of $361,370 with a one-year term for Developmental Services Center Community Employment is presented in this memorandum.
Discussion. Roll call.
Joy Still.
Approved.
Cheryl Hanley Maxwell.
Approved.
Mike Smith.
Approved.
Deb Roush.
Approved.
Developmental Services Center Clinical Services. The request is for $178,986. The motion is to approve partial funding of the amount of $174,000.
Second. Discussion. Roll call.
Joy Still.
Approved.
Cheryl Hanley Maxwell.
Approved.
Mike Smith.
Approved.
Deb Roush.
Approved.
I'm going to follow Mike's lead. This is for Developmental Services Center Apartment Services. The request is for $429,865. The motion to approve partial funding for $417,341.
Second.
Discussion?
Shirley. Oh, I'm sorry.
Roll call.
Cheryl Hanley Maxwell.
Approved.
Mike Smith.
Approved.
Joyce Still.
Approved.
Deb Rouge.
Approved. Community Choices Incorporated Self-Determination Support. The request is for $96,000. I'm going to read it. Aligns with priorities for non-work community life and flexible support and for self-advocacy and family support organizations. It adds stakeholder meetings and self and family advocacy for transition from school to adult life. A special provision will be included to ensure collaboration with CCRPC and other CCDDB, CCMHB funded programs to improve coordination and minimize duplication of effort, including for transition. Motion to deny funding for Community Choices Incorporated Self-Determination Support as presented in this memorandum. By agreement, the Champaign County Mental Health Board will provide funding of $96,000 for this program.
Second.
Discussion.
Since we're not funding, I don't feel obliged to say this, but I feel compelled to say it. How's that? I would love to see Community Choices working with the school districts to ensure that they begin self-determination preparation as early as middle school, because we know from the literature that people who come out of school self-determined need less supports in the long run and are less dependent on external funding mechanisms to live a quality of life.
Okay, thank you. Any other discussion? Roll call.
Joyce Still.
Approved.
Cheryl Hanley Maxwell.
Approved.
Mike Smith.
Approved.
Deb Rouge.
Approved.
Community Choices request is for $99,000, aligns with priority for employment supports and services. The motion is to approve partial funding of $74,103 for Community Choices. Customized employment as presented in this memorandum.
Second.
Discussion? Roll call.
Mike Smith.
Approved.
Joyce Still.
Approved.
Cheryl Hanley Maxwell.
Approved.
Deb Rouge.
Approved.
Community Choices, Inc., Community Living request is for $66,000. This is another of the programs that we're turning over to the Mental Health Board. So the motion is to deny at our level, and we assume will be approved at the Mental Health Board.
Second. And discussion.
There we go. Request is for $66,000, and we are denying funding, and the agreement is with the Mental Health Board, which will provide $63,000. Is that correct? Mm-hmm. Okay. All right. That's all.
Where you see almost all of the reduced recommendations are based on the current year level, but you can tell from the spreadsheet if that's the case, and this is one of those.
Did we get a second on that?
Okay. Roll call.
Cheryl Hanley Maxwell.
Approved.
Mike Smith.
Approved.
Joyce Still.
Approved.
Deb Rouge.
Approved.
Champaign County Head Start, Early Head Start, Social Emotional Disability Services. The request is for $55,645. It aligns with comprehensive services and supports for young children and collaborates with other funded programs toward a system of care approach. A special provision will be included to require collaboration with other early childhood programs to avoid duplication of effort and maximize positive outcomes for children. Motion to deny funding of Champaign County Head Start, Early Head Start, social-emotional disability services as presented in this memorandum. By agreement, the Champaign County Mental Health Board will provide funding of $55,645 for this program.
Second. Discussion? Roll call.
Joyce Still.
Approved.
Cheryl Hanley Maxwell.
Approved.
Mike Smith.
Approved.
Deb Ruth.
Approved. Champaign County Down Syndrome Network, CC Down Syndrome Network. Request is for $15,000. It aligns with the priority for self-advocacy and family support organizations, collaborates with other support networks. Input regarding members' service preferences will support CCDDB, CCMHB planning functions. The motion is to approve funding of $15,000 for Champaign County Down Syndrome Network as presented in this memorandum. Discussion? Roll call.
Mike Smith?
Approved.
Joyce Still?
Approved.
Cheryl Hanley Maxwell?
Approved.
Deb Ruch?
Approved.
CU ABLE Community Outreach, new funding request for $13,802. Aligns with priority for self-advocacy and family support organizations, collaborates with other support networks. Input regarding the comprehensive and member service preferences will support CCDDB, CCMHB planning functions. Motion is to approve funding of $13,802 for CU ABLE Community Outreach as presented in this memorandum.
Discussion. There should be some discussion in there about website.
I meant to say input regarding the comprehensive website. I'm sorry.
How about if I just read that sentence again?
It's not part of the motion.
It's not part of the motion, so no problem. Okay.
But it's my understanding, we've had a couple of discussions throughout the year with regard to getting more information out to the general public. Is this what this is to support, or is it more inclined to support agencies and clients as they exist now?
Actually,
the applicant is here, and we could ask directly if you want. My understanding is that this is support for families, but I may have read it wrong.
Hi, I'm Diane Gordon with CU ABLE. What we're trying to CU ABLE overall is family support, and we go out to the community. There are a couple different things we do, but the most important thing right now is that we've got a Facebook group which invites parents, family members, therapists, teachers. So it's a whole group of people that support each other, general questions, recommendations for different services, and so forth. So we consider our job to be able to reach out to families and provide them with ways to find resources and parent support with each other. As far as our website goes, what we're talking about creating is, again, more family-centered to help people find resources available to them, whether it's schools or different medical options, different... like my child has apraxia, so finding different resources for her and sharing those with other people who are just getting diagnoses, et cetera. Does that answer your question, sort of?
Yes, I think that's in line with what we were talking about earlier about wanting to make sure that we could reach more people.
Mm-hmm.
And the overall ability to generate information, I think, is what we were talking about. And I think it does.
Okay. If it helps, just in the last couple of weeks, we've had about a dozen new people, new families, asked to join our group. So I think that we are continuing to reach out to people. We've grown from 500 members to about 540 in the last two or three months. So
thank you.
My understanding is it's all of it is volunteer run so far, and so the money would support some additional activities, right? Like to make the mom's retreat available to more people, and then to pay someone to manage the online instruments. Is that okay?
Any other discussion? Roll call.
Joy Still.
Approved.
Cheryl Hanley Maxwell.
Approved.
Mike Smith.
Approved.
Deb Roush.
Approved.
Yep.
Okay. CTF Illinois Nursing is your request for $6,000, and we have a motion to approve the funding at the full level of $6,000.
Second. And discussion. Roll call.
Cheryl Hanley Maxwell.
Approved.
Mike Smith.
Approved.
Joy Still.
Approved.
Deb Roush.
Approved.
Next is CTF Illinois Advocacy Center. The request is for $77,008. It's to support the transformation from shelter-based services to meaningful community life for those served. Individual preferences, individual needs and preference assessments are central. We have a motion to approve partial funding to $60,000 for CTF Illinois Advocacy Center.
Second. And discussion. I have a question about this program.
Hi, I'm Melissa McDaniel from CTF.
Hi, Melissa. It's my understanding that the first year of funding, a sizable chunk of the money that was allocated for your program was used for rehab of the building, renovation, and so forth, startup costs, mm-hmm. and so forth. And in your response on page 9 to some questions by the reviewer last month, you kind of indicated that you would expect your funding this year to help pay for individuals from Champaign County who would like to participate in the program. But then I also read somewhere that you were using a sizable amount of money, or your main focus was going to be on interviewing, outreach, staff training. Could you clarify that a little bit?
So our initial application did have more the staff base, but when they asked about the questions about dual funding and all of that kind of stuff, we decided to switch it to more of a fee-for-service. So we said we would do 185 direct service hours. Right now we have, by the end of June, we'll have 6 people attending, but what we're finding is we have a lot of people interested that do not have funding and can't afford private pay. So we would like to use those 185 hours to be able to allow those people to have a chance to come in and to receive services.
I really admire the self-advocacy piece of this program. I'm wondering, I think that your individuals really stay on site, though, most of the time. Mm-hmm. Is there any movement toward practicing the skill development that they will acquire in your setting in real-world situations more often? Is there movement in that direction?
Yes, and this year, I mean, they got a late startup by the time the building got done and everything, so they're just getting acclimated. Our other programs that this is modeled after, they do a lot of research and writing and planning at the base, but they are very active, whether it's going to Springfield to advocate for larger statewide issues, to local, some of them going to the library, the courthouse, meeting different members to advocate for those issues, but as well as individual issues. If they have a course of action that they want to take, then we support them and they go and do that. So I would say in our Charleston advocacy program, that's completely 100% up and going, they're probably about 50% in and out. Because they do, I mean, they do a lot of research and writing, and they just, like, created a training that they are putting on and that they are going out to schools and other providers and our individuals as well and getting paid to do the training as far as rights and slash abuse, so, like, a peer-to-peer support training. So they did write that in-house, but they go out to give it.
So I have another question and follow-up to that. So they're doing this instead of working in the community?
We found when we found some people that this is kind of their passion, is to speak their story. And so we are trying to give them skills to be able to maybe look at alternative employment in the future, as far as we have people getting paid for their speakings and as far as different trainings that go out. And then some people were just very interested in doing advocacy, so an alternative to day program. We have one gentleman who works in the morning and then comes in the afternoon. So he works out in the community, and in the afternoon, this is what he does.
I'm trying to find a way to phrase this. I am extremely uncomfortable funding a program that has no active planning to move people into a situation where they will receive pay for the work that they're doing, whether it's through the advocacy or finding a job in the community that matches their interests. I don't think they're any different than anybody else. You can't continue to volunteer to do the work if you aren't receiving pay for something that you're doing.
Right. That is the end goal. Like with our training that we do for abuse and neglect, they do peer-to-peer, they are paid to give that training. So they wrote the training, they go out and present it, and they receive a check for doing it.
Okay. I don't know how else to phrase this. So.
I have a question, too. How does Champaign County money affect what's happening in Charleston?
It's not. We just modeled the program. In Charleston, we had to kind of give you some history, it does not do anything with Charleston, the Champaign County money. In Charleston, we had a large shelter workshop. We have downsized it to different pods. We have like an art program. We have the advocacy program to get people based on their interest to look for different ways of employment and how to spend their day. So kind of an alternative to the traditional sheltered workshop. They're different pods. It worked really well, so we thought we would offer that opportunity, the advocacy center, up here in Champaign. So the money all stays in Champaign. We just modeled it off of our program in Charleston.
All right.
Because we had such success, and people really, really like the program down there.
And how many people have moved out of this alternative to sheltered workshop? In the Charleston program.
15 people moved from a sheltered workshop, and they work in the advocacy program.
How many people have moved out of the advocacy program into employment?
We have 3 people that do work, and then in their spare time, this is what they do as well.
Okay. So therein lies my problem with this. It may be an alternative to sheltered work, but it is still sheltered employment or sheltered care. And I'm really struggling with this because I would rather see that there are active plans for individuals to move them from just simply staying in the center and or working like an hour or two out to do these things that they've created in the center to moving them into employment roles in the community.
I understand what Cheryl's saying because you're still, it's still kind of a segregated program, I guess, is kind of what I see it as, mm-hmm. at a time when we have been encouraging kind of long-term providers in Champaign County to look beyond that. I still, though, believe that in a time when we don't have adequate funding for to really just get everybody or as many people as can tolerate it in the community in full-time employment. I am heartened at least a little bit to hear that some of your people have some paid employment, and then this particular niche, so to speak, that's focused on their interests and their skills is where they come after. But I kind of would hope that your end goal is to find longer periods of employment during the day so that there's less time in that segregated setting. Any other discussion?
Is it possible to use part of the time you have this year in creating plans that will actually do more active connection between part-time employment and the work that they're doing in the center and moving towards more hours in the community?
I believe so, yes. I mean, I kind of, do you mean as looking for alternative work employment? Like for other, or it's focusing on their advocacy, if that's their goal, if they want to go give speeches or have a radio show or write a newsletter. I mean, that's kind of the employment we're looking for because that's what their passion is.
I guess there's a little bit of a philosophical difference. To me, people who have those types of interests to be advocates kind of do that after work, yeah. Or that's their weekend work, or their passion. I'm using the word hobby, but that's not. That's just their passion and their interest that they take beyond their work day. Yeah, I guess. So I think that's where we're coming from. Mm-hmm. Do you agree?
Yeah, that's exactly it.
Yeah. So that's why there's, you know. I think that there are some good bones to this program if there's direction toward beyond advocacy for advocacy's sake. You know, that we're looking at more community-based outcomes for people beyond the bricks and mortar of your building. And that, you know, and I hope that this can be move into maybe being more like an after-hours program or some way to actually provide a setting for that interest more like along the lines of hobby, rec, leisure,
avocation,
right.
I think maybe this is sort of what I was referring to when I talked about the pilot in the very beginning. I think maybe I misunderstood what I thought you were going to do in your program. And I think I agree with exactly what the two of you said, although my feeling is different about it. I know that we have to move away from sheltered workshops and sheltered programs. And unless I just don't think we should be funding something that doesn't push in that direction. Mm-hmm. Now, the other side of me says anything that we can fund that is an advocacy for disabilities is a good thing for us to do as well. It's difficult. It's hard to sort of put a line down the page and say mm-hmm. it falls over here or it doesn't fall over here. I think what I'd love to hear you say that you want to work toward putting people to work in an environment that doesn't reflect the sheltered workshop, because we all believe that those are going away and there will be no future in that. And I don't really want to spend $60,000 creating something that we have to destroy at a later time. Now, so I think I would like to know that as you train these people to be advocates, that you're also trying to find a position for them to go out and be a voice for advocacy, and where are those going to be, and so on and so forth. Are we on the same page with
right,
that?
Right.
So I think there's something missing in what we felt you were going to be doing with that.
Okay.
My name is Kyla Chantos. I'm the coordinator of the Advocacy Center. And I just wanted to clarify a couple of points on what we do day to day. A lot of what we do, we take a look at what they want, what their dreams and their goals are, and then we work from that. So there are a lot of there's a lot of individual goals. Quite a few of our individuals don't want to be living in a group home, and they don't want to be living at home. So we take a look at what their goals are. We set up strategies with them, and so they're learning how to find a job. They're learning how to find an apartment. They're learning how to pay bills, establish checking accounts, looking at a map of a fictitious town, for example, and decide, well, here's where I work. Here are three apartment complexes that are close. Which one will be the best? So we're looking at wants and needs. We're looking at more real life for those individuals. There are some individuals that are working on more basic skills of, you know, paying next dollar or safety in the community. So we aren't always within those 6 hours in a day in the building. We are out practicing these skills. We're in the community. And another element that we like to focus on is building social capital. So we want them out depending upon their needs and what they want, finding clubs, finding groups, finding organizations that they can participate in with neurotypical peers, whether it is, you know, a 66-year-old woman who wants to join a senior center and participate in bingo every Friday. That's something that she wants to do. That's something that we help her develop the strategies and tools that she needs. As far as employment, half of our individuals have competitive employment already, part-time, and we have collaborative relationships with a lot of agencies here in Champaign-Urbana who do offer supported employment, but we do have those collaborative relationships with them to make sure that they are in, you know, to help making sure that they are in some sort of competitive employment situation. But then and some of our individuals don't have that capability, and so we work volunteer. We work on those pre-vocational, pre-employment skills where they're going and doing, you know, volunteer work. And right now those individuals are new to us, so we're still exploring those options and their capabilities. But that is the long-term goal, is if they aren't able to have we aren't able to have a collaborative relationship with Community Choices or Cunningham, those who offer employment support, that we can look at maybe looking at volunteer work for those who don't have the skills to hold a job.
So I'm going to say that support employment was created in 1985 for the very people that people said weren't ready for employment. Mm-hmm. And in fact, we placed many, many people since the 80s who have mm-hmm. had untestable IQs, multiple mm-hmm. disabilities. And so the pre-employment idea mm-hmm. has not been something that has been proven to be a valid argument mm-hmm. for not allowing people into the community for employment.
Oh, no, that's, I'm so sorry. Let me clarify. That is not the direction I was taking. What I mean is that they've never been exposed. Not that they don't have the skill set or the ability. They don't have the skill set to go into work in a job. So we want to build up a skill set. If that clarifies.
No, it does. It still is at odds with my own experience.
Okay.
Learning the job skills can occur in a job, in multiple jobs. The idea that you have to learn them in isolation of actually being on the job is not a notion that I feel is backed up by the research. I don't have a problem with what you guys are doing because mm-hmm. I think the work that you are doing is really important work and on all levels from what you described. I simply have a problem with them doing it every day for 6 hours for every week and then ad infinitum where there is mm-hmm. no end in sight for this, because to me that's simply moving the sheltered workshop and calling it something different.
Mm-hmm. No, I completely understand. I understand your point. But most of our individuals determine how much time they want to be there. And it is not a guaranteed 9 to 3, 6 hour position. Most of our individuals are there for 3 hours because they work in the mornings and they come to us and work on their independence, work on their goals, work on advocacy, work on understanding their basic individual human rights for those remaining hours of the day. So we don't, at this point, we don't have anyone there 6 hours a day, and I really don't anticipate that we probably will, because we want them out, you know, in competitive employment.
What is your connection to the agencies that are doing the supported employment? What kind? How do you partner with them?
Just working collaboratively, staying in contact with them. And right now, the individuals that we have already have that relationship established with them. But in the future, when we have individuals that come in that want or need a competitive employment situation, then we will work with them to see, like, a time partnership, I guess, is what I'm trying to say. Working with them to establish some sort of a program, some sort of an employment program for that individual.
I don't know why I'm struggling with words today. Self-advocacy on all levels is best taught within the context of its use, not in a separate setting.
Mm-hmm.
And so I would hope that as you're working with those who are providing employment services or residential services,
mm-hmm.
that in fact you are co-planning and co-delivering the kinds of self-advocacy training that is essential in those settings.
Mm-hmm.
Again, I'm going to fall back to the literature saying that most mm-hmm. people who fit into the categories that we are looking at do not generalize well when they have learned information in a separate setting. It does not work
right.
in the next setting that they go to. And I'm concerned that if you aren't collaborating with the employment providers, with the residential service providers, to have these skills used in their settings of use, then it's a lot of time spent in something that will not transfer.
Correct.
I think we're ready for roll call.
Joyce Dill.
Deny.
Cheryl Hanley Maxwell.
Wow. I'd like to say, can we reconsider this? Would that be an additional information needed? Can I move to defer this vote?
That's priority.
Okay, so I can.
Yeah, it's got priority.
Okay, so I'd like to move to defer this vote so that we can have a little more time to discuss.
Second. Discussion?
On the deferral.
What I would like to do is I'd like to get a better sense with CTF about how they can move towards a model where they are a supplement to what is going on in the other activities of these individuals' lives, where they are providing the supports and the guidance that helps these people explore their passions and interests while also supporting their effective inclusion in the community.
So the motion is to defer partial funding of $60,000 for CTF Illinois Advocacy Center as presented in this memorandum. Roll call. Okay. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Opposed?
Who's next? I think I just read that one.
Okay. CCRPC Community Services Decision Support Person for CCDDB. The request is for $86,640. It aligns with the priority for linkage and advocacy for people with IDDD, supports conflict-free case management and person-centered planning, supports transition from high school to adult life and identification of desired supports for future funding priorities. A special provision will be included to ensure collaboration with other CCDDB, CCMHB-funded programs to minimize duplication of effort and move toward conflict-free case management, including for those in transition. The motion is to approve funding of $86,460 for CCRPC Community Services Decision Support Person for CCDDB, CCMHB, as presented in this memorandum.
Second.
Discussion.
I'm confused. It was this not to assist the other agencies by not having them have to be so involved in the meetings and so on and so forth? We were turning over responsibility for to CCRPC for some of the things that we thought we were having to pay duplicates for in other agency. But what we've heard today is that the agencies don't really want to not attend the meetings and not do those things and so forth. So it looks like now we're going to be paying for it in the agencies and paying for it at RPC. I think either we haven't been specific enough in what we were expecting from the agencies, or we're something. It just seems like we're double paying.
Actually, for several years, I've asked the agencies not to attend IEPs with CCDDB funding, but it hasn't been officially in the contracts, and so the practice continues. And then during this year, we've learned about some families really not preferring that. The reason, so this would add to the activities that the Independent Service Coordination unit has done on behalf of the DDB. It would add people to take on that transition piece so that the agencies would not need to be present. The ISC is the only conflict-free case manager in the mix. Well, actually, Vicki Nieswander's planning model is also conflict-free because there are no other services to refer to. Conflict-free case management is the law. It's in the federal regulations around long-term supports and services now, and Illinois' model for accomplishing that conflict-free case management rests on the Independent Service Coordination Unit, but they don't fund them for all of the activities that we believe are necessary at this time.
What do you mean by conflict-free?
A conflict-free case manager would be able to do planning and needs assessment that doesn't refer people to programs that they also run. It's seen as, that's the conflict, is that.
Okay.
But at the same time, with the acknowledgement of the value of case management services, we haven't really pushed towards that total independence from service providers. But in this area, it would appear to be helpful.
When a client is already being represented or being serviced by an agency, and they ask the agency to attend them like we heard today, we shouldn't be in a position of saying, no, you can't go to that meeting. That doesn't seem right to me either. But by the same token, I understand now what conflict-free means, and I understand that's a good thing. So what do we get by giving RPC $87,000 or whatever? What do we get for that for the clients, for the citizens of Champaign County? That's what I'm asking.
The idea was to have some transition planning that went to the hub, which the ISC is still responsible for determining eligibility for everybody, whether it's locally funded services or state funded services. So they need to be involved with all those cases anyway, and some of those are on our behalf because so many people are supported only with local dollars. So we want to make sure that the people who only have local funding for their services have the same protections and rights as people whose funding is coming from the federal and state mix. And so this would help to get us there where those.
So this is a mandate of RPC to do this no matter what. And RPC is funded separately by separate dollars, correct?
But because we have significant additional dollars to support people in services, there's nothing mandated on behalf of those people to protect them from potential conflicts of interest.
Okay. Where I was going was, RPC is not already being paid to do this by state dollars or real estate taxes that go to them through the county. This is something different.
Correction. RPC is grant fund. There's no property taxes.
There's no property taxes in it. So the grants are federal or state or county? All grants. I guess, yes. That'd be good.
She's the expert, and I'm really not.
Okay, then.
Hi, Lisa Benson, Regional Planning Commission. Fire away.
I'm the one asking questions. I did not have a clear understanding of how RPC is funded, and we realized it through grants. But my concern is, do you already have a grant to do what this is talking about?
No.
And are we? No.
No.
But you already do this.
We are not provided funding through the state to do transition planning with those coming out of schools into independent living. And that's what we were proposing to do. If they were state waiver funded, they would do discovery and person-centered planning. However, these individuals that I'm understanding are not going, we would not, transition planning consultants would not engage in services with people that had other funding sources to do the work. So the proposal is to offer to families that are interested in working with a transition planning consultant to do the work. Again, we do not know how many would be in that need and how much the funding would support. So we proposed to do a certain number.
Okay. It's not a duplication of funding, then. That was my question.
No, it is not.
As Lisa suggested during the discussion with agency input, you know, if this meant that we had them in the room and an agency provider who's already working with a client, that wouldn't even be duplication of effort, right?
That is correct. And again, I also would envision if there's a longstanding service provider that's working with a family, I would envision that they probably are establishing and have begun to establish a transition plan. The family might not be interested or work with us. They might say we would pass on a transition planning consultant and continue to work with the provider that they're working with.
Okay. I think that did. Thank you very much.
I just want to say I like this application because so many times families don't understand the world of adult services. They don't have a comprehensive picture of what's available and not available in our county. And everything is done in kind of a piecemeal fashion. The school districts don't do what I believe they are obligated to do via this school code. And I think, you know, just like we need a comprehensive resource guide for families that happens through the Disability Resource Expo, we need to get as much information to families in the transition planning stages as possible so they know where to go and what to do next. And so many times, despite the best efforts of our agencies, people don't have information. So I see this as the best way in a conflict-free, objective, it's not perfect, but it's the most objective, conflict-free proposal that I think we can come up with at this point to address that need. Roll call.
Joyce Still.
Approve.
Mike Smith.
Approve.
Deb Roush.
Approve.
You probably remember it. You might remember it, but this is a worst-case scenario motion, and it actually happened a few years ago, and we had to implement reductions across the board with all the agency contracts. I think we were really lucky this year that we didn't end up having to do that when we discovered that the revenue shortfall. But on that note, I expect things to continue to be always unpredictable, sometimes lucky, but this is our worst case scenario protection. It's just in case the property tax levy is lower than what we've projected for this set of allocations. It gives us the authority to make contract reductions.
What if you get more money than expected?
Because we do all this, the allocation decision, the application process on this half of the fiscal year, when we're really far away from knowing what's coming, it might be good for us to look at our budget in November when we get real news from the county.
I mean, budgets are predictions. They're not necessarily.
Exactly. But we may have a better prediction at mid-year. And Mike Smith and I were talking about that recently, that there might be some value in looking to see where we're at. And this doesn't say contract adjustments upward, but if we found ourselves in such a happy situation, I think we could have a discussion like that.
What we talked about was taking a second look at a different time of the year than right at the end of the budgeted year, because it's difficult at that time to understand what's going to happen May, June, when we could look at it down the road and see what, have a backwards look at the previous year and a forward look at the current year and see if we can make some adjustments. And if we can, then we can come forward with that. We can go to the agencies and say, hey, turns out we've got an extra, you know, so-and-so, okay?
The news about the property tax revenues comes in November, right? I mean, we get bits of what we can anticipate starting in June, but the final, when we do our budget approval with the county, that's when we really kind of know what's coming. But this year it changed in September, and then again in November, and then again this spring. And that has to do with the things I mentioned earlier that are outside of our control.
I move to approve this.
Second. Discussion. And roll call.
Joyce Still?
Approve.
Mike Smith?
Approve.
Deb Roush?
Approve.
Deborah, a couple comments. I was looking at the way you approved or denied some of these, and Robert's Rules would recommend you do it differently. Robert's Rules recommends that if you have a motion to approve something and you vote yes, the resulting answer is positive. In this case, you actually had a motion to deny approval, so you had a negative, you voted positively to have a negative result, which can be confusing. Now, I'm not saying you were confused, but it can confuse other people. So I recommend in the future you have all the motions should be a motion to approve X funding for so-and-so account. Then you can say the recommendation is for approval, recommendation is for denial. Also, it didn't happen today, but it's possible if you had a motion to deny, and let's say you denied that denial, and then you've got, but you're supposed to be approving money, and in this case you actually want to approve the money, but you didn't. So it would make it more complex.
Okay, so then moving on to old business, item 13. Just for information, I'm just going to go through these. A is agency third quarter reports that are provided for information. They begin on page 38 through 59. Okay, B is our meeting schedule, which is on page 60 and 61. And Lynn, you have a question about that?
I have three questions about it. First, this adds meetings for the second half of 2017. You've never seen them before. We just booked the room using the pattern. We don't know if this is going to work for you all. So that's one question. Will this work for you all? Second question is, should we continue this pattern for the first half of 2018 so that you can see the next year's worth of meetings? And the third question is, that's good news and bad news. On June 21st, I'll be in Washington, D.C. with a team from Champaign County. SAMHSA is paying for us to attend a best practices training for 3 days, so I won't be able to do this meeting. And one of the things we're scheduled to work on at this meeting is the budget. So I would really prefer to be here if we can move it to June 28th or just hold all that business till the July meeting. So that was my third question, probably the most important one.
Do we have to decide on that now, or can we mull that over and see, look at our schedules? Okay, all right.
Question at page 61. It said, statement says, included the meeting dates is the tentative schedule for the CCDDB allocation process for contract year 2018, but they're not listed.
This document is based on the schedule, so we haven't, well, we have a draft of it in the office, but we didn't include it. Yeah.
Okay, C. The LIGAS acronyms are included, as always, on pages 62 and 63. Are there any board announcements? I have nothing to say. Anybody else have anything to announce? Yes?
I don't, but I'd sort of like to know what we're going to do about the deferred contract. How are we going to be ready to vote on that next month?
When I was looking for dates to reschedule that June 21st meeting, I asked about June 14th, and I think this room is not available on June 14th. But given that it's just one vote, maybe we should look at June 7th. I didn't even look because it was coming up so quickly, too quickly to do the budget. But
what about, do we have to vote? I mean, I know we've deferred for a month, but could we defer? Will it be a hardship on the agency if we defer till the July meeting instead of the June meeting?
Yes, I imagine it would. It would.
Okay. Then maybe we should look to the 24th or 28th, whatever that date, alternate date you had in June that we can do.
I think the 28th would be too late to get them a July payment. I mean, they would still get a July payment, but it would be quite delayed.
Okay.
So I'm really happy that you mentioned this because I forgot that we did this.
Okay, so we probably should take the 7th?
We can look into the 7th and... I mean, I think we can get the meeting materials together for that because it's quite simple business.
Okay. Okay. Then I guess if we need a move or a suggestion or whatever, okay. I'm saying let's try to meet the 7th. And if we have to meet at a different time, then we better do whatever we can do.
Would that work for you all, too?
Okay. Yeah, we can do that.
Is that, Stephanie, is that going to work?
I have no idea.
But you're the...
For who?
You're the brains of the operation.
No clue.
We have the... Stephanie puts all the meeting materials together for us and you know, keeps us in line with the Open Meetings Act, and so that's why I just...
Historically,
getting nervous.
June and July meetings.
Yes. Mm-hmm. That's right. And, you know, there have been years where you did not have a June meeting. You're required by statute to have a July meeting. That's the only thing you're actually required. Okay. So do you think we can do it on June 7th if the room is available?
And if we have a quorum.
Okay. All right.
We'd need to check with everybody to see if they're in town to come to a meeting.
Okay. Thank you.
I guess we'll try for that then on June 7th. And we'll leave it as such at this point. So I would like to entertain a motion to adjourn.
I move we adjourn the meeting.
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Meeting adjourned.